Welcome to the Farmers Weekly podcast. This episode recorded on Friday, the 5th of February, 2021. From the Farmers Weekly news desk, I'm Johan Tasker.
And I'm Hugh Broom.
In this week's episode, livestock nutrition, plant nutrition. But what about farmer nutrition? What do you eat when you're working flat out?
Be on the way back home from combining at 10 o'clock at night and you'll drive past the golden arches and it's all too tempting to pull in there and get a quick takeaway.
In the markets, is the heat coming out of high value commodities?
We've been fighting this war out between South American supplies and Chinese demand, essentially. And it's those two factors which will probably determine, certainly in the short to medium term, where we go next.
Could farmers be paying the price for lack of progress on the environment? The government is not as green as it says, according to a top committee.
Sometimes Whitehall is not very good at, to say the least, understanding what the reality is on the ground. So they do need a champion, and they need to understand the reality, and they need to be listening, crucially, to those people who, particularly farmers, actually, who are really important stewards of the environment.
And we'll be previewing this year's Farmers Weekly Awards.
We're some of the best food producers in the world, and we need to celebrate that success and give those individuals who are doing so well a boost, but also to inspire those who want to do better.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
But first, incidents of livestock worrying have gone up 10% this year, and it's costing the industry £1.3 million per annum, as well as the welfare impact on the animals and the distress caused to the keepers and owners of the animals involved. Insurer NFU Mutual, as well as collating those figures, also carried out a survey of 1,200 dog owners. Rebecca Davison is from the Mutual.
Behind the figures, obviously, is this perennial problem, but I think it has got worse in the last year. It certainly seems to back up a lot of reports that we're hearing from farmers. And we're finding that more people are out and about in the countryside. Maybe new visitors aren't familiar with the countryside code. There's been a massive surge in dog ownership as well. People probably not researching the breed, maybe not training them, maybe not even come into contact with livestock before. And so I think that's a lot of a reason behind the rise in the last year.
Gerald Ketley is from Essex. He lost over 40 sheep in one attack late last year.
I went to the first sheep and yes, she lay there dead. And I picked her up and put her in the Land Rover and I drove over the other side of the field and I saw another one. But as I went to lift this up, it's I could see all its inside of its leg had all been savaged and tore away. And I turned round and to see in the bush behind me was this sheep that was distressed. And this poor sheep was there with no ears left. And they weren't shredded. They were just taken right back to the head, the skull of the bone on the, in the ear.
Rebecca Davison from the Mutual told us many owners admit to not being able to control their dogs.
For the last 3 years, we've carried out a survey with over 1,200 dog owners, and it's given us some really interesting results. When asked, a lot of owners say, of course, I'll put the dog on the lead when there's a sign, but we know that's not always the case. So what we found was that 64% of dog owners are letting their pets roam free in the countryside, so they're letting them off the lead. But half of them admit that the dog doesn't always come back. So the dogs don't have any recall. And so that's part of the problem. And also, a lot of them were saying that they've noticed more people exercising their pets in rural areas. That was over 80%. So, of course, there's been a huge influx of people walking across fields when there are livestock around.
Meanwhile, in Scotland, the government there wants to change the law and increase penalties. Fines of up to £5,000 and six-month jail terms are being proposed. Charlie Adam is Vice President of NFU Scotland.
It is proposing an increase in penalties and greater investigative powers. There are a lot of things in it to be welcomed. There are one or two things which we feel maybe ought to have gone a little bit further, not least related to whether or not compensation might be paid to farmers for damage done by dog worrying incidents, because at the moment the only recourse people have is through the civil courts, and any cost related to that probably would outweigh any compensation that might be paid. And we also feel that maybe there should be a little more spreading of powers beyond dog wardens in terms of control orders, and maybe other appropriate bodies other than the police might also be given powers to enforce the law.
He's hopeful for a change in the law soon.
Well, the best information I have is that although the Scottish elections are coming and Purdy begins on the 25th of March, I'm told there's a fairly good chance and time that the bill might make its progress through its stages before Parliament shuts down. We very much hope that will be the case.
That's Charlie Adam, who's the Vice President of NFU Scotland. Johan, this problem doesn't seem to get any better. It just seems to carry on. It's actually getting worse year on year.
Yeah, it's about time people started calling it by its real name as well, Hugh. A lot of people call it livestock worrying, don't they? But really and truly, let's call it what it is. It's dog attacks on sheep. And, you know, it's people, dog walkers, they don't listen. I mean, you know, we live out in the sticks on the Essex-Suffolk border. There are more people walking around the village with dogs. You see them on footpaths, dogs off the lead. People think it's okay because they can't see the sheep. But, you know, dog runs off and the next thing you know, it's in a field mauling animals. It's not on.
No, it's not. And the big problem is, look, there's several instances where this happened. My experience of it here on the farm at home, we probably have 100 dog walkers use our farm every day, day in, day out. 99.99% of them are fantastic. They phone me when anything's wrong. There has been instances where their dogs have attacked sheep and they phoned up and owned up to it. Equally, we have other times, and we don't get too many, dare I say it, where we have had attacks. But it's generally when someone from out of the area comes in and they don't realise they're there, they just don't think about it. It's bad enough the dogs being off the leads and sort of trying to run under a tractor when you're trying to get from A to B without them attacking the livestock. Look, the whole thing needs a big review. And I think what it actually needs is we're drip feeding this stuff. I mean, fair play to NFU Mutual. They release these figures every year because obviously farmers can insure against livestock attack. And that's where the 1.3 million quid comes from. So the figure's probably higher because there'll be a load of people that aren't actually insured. And also not all of these incidences are being reported.
I think the public need educating as well. I mean, you know, if you try and talk to dog owners, some of them just won't believe that their dogs are their pets as they see them. Their dogs just aren't capable of attacking sheep. They think they're lovely, they think they're cuddly, they just think that everything's okay, you know, it won't happen kind of thing. But in all too many cases, it certainly does.
And as we heard in the package, there's some great news from Scotland that the legislation, it looks like they're trying to change it. They're modernising it, they've beefed up the penalties, beefed up the investigative powers, and also effectively making the dog owners far more culpable for these incidents than they currently are now. So that is great news. And hopefully, if that can get through the Scottish Parliament, there is absolutely no reason why, and as the Prime Minister likes to talk about oven-ready laws, he has got an oven-ready law there. The First Minister of Wales has got an oven-ready law there. The First Minister of Northern Ireland has got an oven-ready law there that they can take out, tweak, and pretty quickly put on the statute book and get on top of this. And at the same time, our industry needs to come together, all the organisations, landowner organisations, farmer organisations, sheep, whatever, just come together. Let's have one big push, get this law changed, and hopefully we can see the back of this problem and we won't be hearing about it as often as we are now. Your members don't care who does it first. They just want some action to happen now.
Hi, I'm Darren Hobbs, agricultural contractor based in Taunton, Somerset. Contract baling is a very competitive market, so we need a baler which can handle varied weather conditions. It has to be fast, reliable, and produce good bales of consistent size and density. I've used Welga balers in the past and been very happy with them. When this was finally ready for an update, I made the choice and never looked back. I looked at the new Massey Ferguson balers, liked the design which obviously retains best points from the Welga models, which includes practical improvements too. Massey Ferguson baler made an excellent start on its maiden season with us. We already run Massey Ferguson tractors, so we were confident it would go well. We've got a great dealer, so it was a no-brainer. Massey Ferguson was the obvious choice.
For expert results this grass season, speak to your local Massey Ferguson dealer or visit masseyferguson.co.uk.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
So, we're usually telling you how to feed your sheep at this pre-lambing time, or indeed feed your cows ahead of calving. or how to feed your wheat, but how should you actually feed yourself? And at times of high labour demand on the farm, routine and personal well-being can get neglected. Longer than normal hours, along with poor diet, can lead to excessive tiredness and poor health. Now, how do we get this right? Well, it's a bit of planning, a bit of thinking ahead. Earlier on, I spoke to Anna Groom, who is a qualified dietitian, and I started by asking her how we should plan for busy times.
It really depends what the additional hours are going to be, because that's going to have an effect on our sleep and also on our food choice. So if we think about kind of working overtime, working excessive hours, not having quality sleep, it increases your risk of choosing high sugar foods, which increase your blood glucose levels, and then you get a slump later. So you kind of get into this cycle of feeling high, feeling low, feeling high, which kind of perpetuates then into kind of feeling excessively tired as well. So we need to think about having healthy options, but things that are sustainable as well. So if we're thinking about snacks, for example, choosing an oat-based flapjack rather than just a chocolate bar.
Not surprisingly, starting the day with a good breakfast is key.
Do you want something like a whole grain breakfast, whether you can have like a porridge or a no added sugar muesli or egg or beans on toast, something like that, to give you a really good start for the day. And then having those snacks that we've just suggested, so things like the oat-based bars, nuts and dried fruit, that kind of thing. Trying to have things like the main part of a meal as a sandwich or a cold pasta bake if you've had that the night before, you know, low calorie crisps, that kind of thing at lunchtime with a drink, and then to say the snacks in the afternoon. And then if possible, when you come in, if you've not got, you know, a meal ready, if there's not someone that's cooking it for you, then things are really quick and easy. So, you know, even if it's something like microwave rice cooked with frozen vegetables and a tin of fish in there, you know, for one night, that's still going to be fine. But trying to make things quick and easy rather than, you know, I have some farmers that will go for things like pot noodles and that kind of thing, which, you know, very high in salt, very high in fat, and don't actually give you much long-lasting energy. You don't want high caffeine and high sugar, because whilst it's going to give you an immediate hit, you're going to get a slump, and it's going to be a lower slump later.
And for many, it's all too tempting to eat rubbish all day long. Essex farmer Ed Ford is easily lured by drive-in treats after a long day on the combine.
We're all guilty of it. Too busy to eat healthily, and you know, you'll get in, you'll be on the way back home from combining at 10 o'clock at night, and you'll drive past the Golden Arches, and it's all too tempting to pull in there and get a quick takeaway. My worst one actually is BP garages, Wild Bean Cafe, bacon and cheese turnovers, £2 each. It's just all too easy to do that, but you know, sat on your bum all day on a tractor, you've really got to think how many calories you're actually burning, which isn't an awful lot.
Anna Groom also told me that good diet is key to protecting your immune system.
What we know is that if you have really poor nutrition for a length of time, as well as lots of tiredness and high stress and anxiety levels, which lambing is obviously a very stressful time, it can have a negative effect on the immune system. So, you know, where possible, trying to have fruit and veg, whether or not that's tinned, fresh, frozen. I mean, something like overnight oats is always a good option as well, you know, having yogurt and plus some oats and then some frozen berries. It's not expensive, but it again gives you another good meal, whether it's breakfast or a snack to take with you, and just to sort of support the immune system during this time.
That's Anna Groom there from Suffolk ending that report.
We've all done it, Hugh, I guess. You know, eating bad food at a busy time. I remember grain carting, and yeah, you sort of end up living on things like Cornish pasties and big 2 litre bottles of Coke if you're not careful.
Scotch eggs and Red Bull. The worst thing they ever did was put food into garages. I think it was a lot more healthier when it was just little cans of oil and fan belts. But yes, it is difficult, isn't it? Look, there's going to be people listening to this who are really lucky that have got a wife or a mum or a dad or someone at home that's cooking for them regularly. And some people operate like that, and that's fantastic. But more and more, we're on our own. You know, the other half's gone out to work. There's only one person at home, and so you've got to do it all yourself. And so, yeah, it becomes more and more important. And where you've got that perfect family set up, it's fantastic. And everyone has breakfast breakfast and lunch and dinner at the same time, and then they all go off and lamb the sheep or do ever. But there's a heck of a lot of people, I think, operating where that doesn't happen. So getting it right is really important. So, yes, stay off the Red Bull and the Scotch eggs. And you can't actually power the grain cart with 20 B&H an hour as well, which is what used to happen in student days. Yes, he's got to be a lot healthier, a lot more sensible.
A lot more healthier indeed. Yeah, Anna talks a lot of sense. She actually lives about 4 miles away from me in Suffolk. She's a registered dietitian and she's a farmer's wife, so she knows the score when it comes to farming. And the way that I met her, Hugh, was she was doing this Fit and Farming course a couple of years ago, and it was all about nutrition. You nurture your crops and you nurture your livestock, as she says. Now it's time to look after yourself. And I went along to do a story for Farmers Weekly, and I was there in the evening, a bunch of other farmers, all different ages, all different shapes and sizes. We had an interesting talk looking at, about food, what we eat and that kind of thing. And then we all did some yoga, believe it or not. And I'd never done yoga before. It's all a bit kind of, the things I do, you see. But it was really, really, really good. And I'm pleased to say Anna's doing this course again. It's actually starts on the 10th of February. It's a 6-week course. It costs £42. She's doing it online because, of course, of coronavirus restrictions, social distancing and that kind of thing. And the good thing about that is that it means that it doesn't matter where you are in the country, as long as you've got a decent internet connection, you can take part. And I would thoroughly, thoroughly recommend it. It makes you look at yourself in a different way and actually question a few of your bad habits and put them right. So if anybody listening wants to attend that course or find a little bit more about it, you can look at Anna's website, which is www.aegnutrition.com.
That's great stuff. Thank you, Johan. And look after yourself. If you're about to head into the lambing shed, take heed and eat wisely.
Hi, I'm Philip Cosgrave from Yarra. It's rarely at the top of any grassland farmer's to-do list, but nonetheless, it's important that you spend some time now putting together a nutrient management plan for each field, using up-to-date soil test results if available. This should inform the type and quantity of any fertiliser you purchase this year. For more information on nutrient management planning, go to yarra.co.uk.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
You are indeed listening to the Farmers Weekly Podcast. Welcome along wherever you may be listening to us. Good to have you with us. If you'd like to get in touch, you can. It's very easy. The best thing is to send us an email, and it's just podcast@fwi.co.uk. That's podcast@fwi.co.uk. If you have some ideas for something we should be covering in the show, or if indeed you just want us to say hello because you're bored on your tractor, we're happy to do that as well. You can also leave some fantastic reviews, which I understand, Johan, people have been doing.
Yeah, our latest review, Hugh, it says it's 5 stars, proper farming podcast, a proper farming podcast that has its focus clearly on farmers and farming, it says. A refreshing change from the BBC's Farmers Moaning Today. I don't really know what they're talking about there. That's from Grassy Wanted Wear. So thank you very much for that one. Hugh, it's time for our weekly progress report on your feeder wagon. Has it made it over from Poland yet?
Do you know, it has actually arrived in the UK yesterday, I think, and even to the point where apparently when it got to Dover, the driver then didn't quite have the perfect paperwork after it taken them 3 weeks to prepare the paperwork to get it from Poland to Dover. So he managed to blag out of the customs compound, apparently didn't have some sort of PIN number or something, and the feeder wagon is now being PDI'd in Basingstoke, and apparently it's now the big task of organising moving it from Basingstoke to Surrey, along with my neighbour who's buying a similar one as well, one of my neighbours. So you never know, we might actually see it this week. That'd be a great thing, wouldn't it?
That'd be really, really good indeed. So if it went from Dover to Basingstoke, it must have gone past yours at Dorking, then you could have waved it on its way.
Well, I could have done, but I didn't know. It must have just flown by on the motorway. But hey, at least it's in the UK and they managed to sort out the paperwork to get it out of Poland anyway.
Right. time for the markets, Hugh. What are the prices doing?
Thank you very much, Johan. Starting with the cattle as ever, finished steer deadweight average this week 378.1. That's up about a penny on the week. The live weight also edges up a penny, 207.8. Sheep, lambs, deadweight average this week 558.4. That's back about 20p on last week. The live weight sheep lamb price, though, has gone up. It's 265.1. That's up about 15 pence on the week. Heading to arable commodities and just starting to cool off a bit. Feed wheat, 196.7 this week. That's back about £4 on the tonne. Milling wheat drops back a massive £11 to £11.60 this week. It peaked out at £221.40 last week. Barley also edging back £160.30 back £2 on last week. Oilseed rape stays solid though. 376.9 is the price of your average ton of oilseed rape this week. Now, if you are thinking about commodities, many would say we've been stuck in a global commodities bubble. We're obviously seeing some heat coming out of that market, but for arable producers, the strong price has done really well to prop up what were some pretty disappointing yields in the 2020 harvest. But for those feeding animals, the last few months have been pretty horrible with an ever-increasing feed bill. And no sign yet, it seems, of it edging back. But have they peaked? And what do we think the first half of 2021 holds in store? Earlier, I spoke to James Webster, who's a senior analyst on things arable at HDB.
I think we've seen them obviously ease back a little bit, sort of more probably a week or so ago, and then they rallied again. And we've been in this sort of global commodities bubble for the last 3 months, really, where we've been fighting this war out between South American supplies and Chinese demand, essentially. And it's those two factors which will probably determine, certainly in the short to medium term, where we go next. So we are at a point, if we talk about commodities on sort of a global scale, where we've got a maize market, and maize is the global grain crop, the biggest grain crop there is. We've got a maize market which is tighter than it's been, sort of looking back to 2013-14 levels, really. And the dryness that we were then seeing in South America, certainly in the early parts of this year, and then all of this strong Chinese buying has helped support that market. It's an interesting one. It's one of those things where for prices to keep rallying, they're going to need more news, essentially. So from the perspective of Chinese buying, we've been having sale reports from the US, which has showed some really big numbers in terms of Chinese buying of US maize. And that's probably what fueled a bit of the rally, certainly in maize prices last week. I mean, it was something like 5.85 million tons of buying, single biggest purchase on Friday from China of US maize by a single nation since USSR made a purchase in 1991 of over 3 million tons. And it's that sort of demand level which has helped to drive things in the direction they've been going. From a sort of a wheat perspective, we've not really seen that same level of demand. And I would say that's probably a little bit of demand destruction to an extent. Up until this week, we had seen some pretty sluggish demand, shall we say, from some of the global importers, and tenders going unanswered and bits and pieces like that, and no purchases being made. We have just had a big purchase from Egypt, but the Egyptians are now saying they're pretty well stocked after this huge purchase they've made this week through until sort of June, July time. And that probably cools the market off a little bit.
And James, with the rest of the economy suffering, hedge funds have been piling their cash into ag markets to try and turn a buck out of poor old farmers. How much do you think that's pushed the markets up?
For me, I think that's probably one of the big risks at the moment for prices is this investment. And it's something we've seen since August, really. We've seen huge investment not only in sort of more traditional ag commodity futures markets. So certainly the managed money position, the hedge fund managers, if you like, their view in grain markets has been to buy and hold maize in particular on the Chicago corn contract. But also we've got these exchange traded funds, which are more traditional packages of products that people buy on sort of a more traditional exchange. And we've seen some huge volumes buy into those as well. And that has certainly elevated the market to a point that we're at the moment. And it does feel sort of, as you look at other bits and pieces sort of outside commodities, that we've almost hit a bit of a bubble in commodity prices and the values of retail investment as well. We've heard in the news sort of outside of agriculture about things like what's going on with GameStop and various other things, but we've got non-traditional people, shall we say, investing in markets. And it does pose a significant risk, I think, for prices, that if we were to see some particularly bearish fundamentals, or just see those fund managers get to a point where they've seen the money and taken the money out of those markets they want to, if we would see an unwinding of that position, then sure, I think weakness in prices is a concern. Those long positions are in corn, in soy as well.
So going forward, James, as well as hedge funds unloading unexpectedly, what else might cause prices to come back even more?
The big sort of fundamental drivers that we're looking at there will probably be South American maize planting, particularly Brazil. They're now going into their Safrina maize crop planting, which is their big crop, their one for the export market. If that looks favourable, if the crop develops well, then we could see some pressure. We've obviously got very high global commodity prices at the moment. That's going to be really attractive as we start to go into the spring crop planting window for the US. And we've seen historically that a lot of acres have sort of moved away from wheat to an extent and into maize and soybeans. And that fight is a really important one for the market between what acres get planted into those two crops. I think if we were to see some big acreage figures for both of those crops, then obviously that fundamental picture looks better supplied. We've also got a Russian crop which is currently in dormancy. So how does that wheat crop look as we come out of the winter period in Russia, and then the development in EU crops? We've come at a point, obviously, from a UK perspective, we've had a very small crop, got a rebound in acreage that we've already seen in our early bird survey data in UK wheat acreage. And there's some pretty favourable conditions as well there has been for the EU crop planting.
James Webster there from AHDB.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Annual direct payments to farmers are being phased out in England to be replaced by a new policy which will reward growers and livestock producers for looking after the environment. It's what government ministers have been telling us for the past 5 years, but we're still waiting to find out how the new environmental land management scheme will work and how much farmers will be paid. Now, this week, an influential committee of MPs has warned of painfully slow government progress on critical issues like air quality, water quality, and wildlife loss. Environmental funding is piecemeal, and DEFRA lacks the clout to lead the rest of government and hold other departments to account, says the Public Accounts Committee. Here's Committee Chair Meg Hillier.
A lot of farmers will know that one policy that sounds like a good idea can cause problems down the line if it hasn't been thought through properly. So that's really what a plan like this ought to be doing, is looking at the timeline. So what happens today, what will that impact be, good or bad, down the line? But also, if we do this, is this counterproductive in terms of another policy from another department that's doing something that's pulling in the opposite direction? And in the end, it's the poor consumer, producer, the smaller person, the taxpayer down the line that is pulled in different directions. And sometimes Whitehall is not very good at, to say the least, understanding what the reality is on the ground. So they do need a champion, and they need to understand the reality, and they need to be listening crucially to those people who, particularly farmers actually, who are really important stewards of the environment, about what the practical issues are. If they don't get that right, they will make grand promises, which, as we've seen, but they won't actually get them delivered. And then that's just, everyone's a loser. It doesn't work.
That's Meg Hillier. The Public Accounts Committee report comes a week after the government again delayed its flagship environment bill, angering opposition MPs. Here's Lib Dem MP Tim Farron, who represents the Cumbrian constituency of Westmorland and Lonsdale.
This is outrageous, but the government will tough it out and will probably bear no consequences for doing so. But there will be huge consequences for our environment, for our biodiversity, for future generations, and indeed for farmers and for food producers.
That's Lib Dem MP Tim Farron. Defra says the latest delay to the Environment Bill is due to the coronavirus pandemic. A Defra spokesperson said, "We are ambitious in our determination to build back greener from the pandemic through a range of actions, including progressing our 25-year environment plan and securing royal assent for the Environment Bill, which will enshrine environmental targets for our air quality, water and biodiversity in law." Farming leaders, though, have described the delay as hugely unhelpful. Here's Harry Greenfield, Senior Advisor for the Country Land and Business Association.
It just underlines that lack of urgency and lack of clarity. And I think from our point of view, we think that the Agriculture Bill and the Environment Bill need to sort of go hand in hand, given that the main part of the Agriculture Bill in some ways is the payment for public goods, so paying for the environment. You need the Environment Bill to kind of give the other side of the coin, really, in terms of what will be paid for and how farmers are going to be able to deliver it.
And until this whole thing gets back on track, what are you advising your members?
So there are things that you can do to prepare, whether that's looking at the opportunities to go into existing stewardship schemes, which might give you, as well as an income stream, give you a sort of flavour of what environmental management looks like at the farm level. Countryside stewardship is one option, but getting more familiar with, I suppose, you know, the green agenda, with whether it's your carbon or other aspects of the environment, thinking about, you know, what wildlife you have on your farm, how you're managing your water resources, what your carbon state of play is. Those things are all going to be useful in the future. And I think that the more information you have right now, the better position you'll be in to take advantage of opportunities in the future. And whether that's looking at sort of new training, gaining new skills, speaking to advisors, I think there's a lot that people can do to prepare, even if we don't know the ultimate endpoint of what ELM is going to look like and what other schemes might be in place.
Harry Greenfield from the CLA. Cambridge-based agribusiness consultant and farm management expert Carl Atkin agrees that the situation is disappointing, but he adds that farmers and land managers must look ahead nonetheless.
Frankly, I think we've been left in quite a difficult position. There's a lot of clarity around the phasing out of direct payments, or at least the first 4 years of that, but very little clarity on what's going to replace it. I had great hopes for the Green Brexit 2019, innovative payment methodologies, reverse auctions, payment by results. You know, it was going to be innovative and groundbreaking. Now, I guess it's inevitable that once that went through the bureaucracy and the machinery of government, it was going to have to be dumbed down to create a scheme that farmers could actually engage with. But I worry that kind of great big vision set by Michael Gove has been lost, partly because of changes of ministerial posts at Defra, and partly because in the kind of machinations of creating a farmer friendly scheme, we're going to end up with something that looks, in my view, much more like continuity stewardship, and to me that would be a great shame and a great sadness if that's where we end up.
There's a lot of advice out there, but is there anything in particular, Carl, that you think farmers should be doing to prepare for this brave new green world?
Most importantly of all, farmers need to be focusing on the development of environmental markets. And again, much of this is very embryonic, but you know, there's a lot of opportunities in my mind around monetizing environmental services, carbon trading and offsetting, biodiversity net gain. And in the medium term, I think the quantum of these market-based environmental income streams will dwarf the fiscal transfer that comes through ELMS or any other government scheme.
That's agribusiness consultant Carl Atkin.
So, Johan, the government needs to, actually do something. It doesn't sound like they've really been doing much for the last 9 or 10 years.
I guess, Hugh, talk is cheap, and that's exactly what they've been doing. They've been talking about doing stuff, but according to the Public Accounts Committee, they haven't really been doing enough at all, and we really need to see some progress. It's beyond the joke. Defra insists that it is taking the environment seriously, but as we heard there, you know, how can you plan for your business? It's the same old story, you know. We just need some clarity. We need some progress. We need to know where things are going and how we can get there.
The key thing here is that the report is not left on the shelf to gather dust. The committee can actually ask, they basically make the departments that they mention respond. So they have to respond at a written response. And they can actually call them back to the committee for a progress report. And reading between the lines, I think that's what they hope to do, to try and keep the pressure on, to keep something actually moving. moving. But what's more worrying is that when you look at the money thing and the fact that the government has effectively only really new money on environment spent £1 billion since 2011 is what they're saying. When you take out the flooding money, there's really not much left at all, which sort of worries slightly. It's back to my analogy of what's use is your Agriculture Act or your Agriculture Bill if the budget's a fiver. So in these times of constrained public expenditure, the pressure really has to be on to try and get the best deal to actually get things to move along. Because as we say, every time we talk about this, nothing is going to move without any incentive at all. It's just not going to happen. The job is going to grind to a halt. So it needs to move somewhere. It needs to move somewhere fairly quick, doesn't it?
It does. I was speaking to Carl Atkin, though, who we heard from there, the agribusiness consultant from Cambridge, and his point of view is that the industry has become fixated about this £3 billion that it currently receives through the CAP, or it has received through the CAP, and the government's pledged to match that money for the duration of this parliament and ensure that the same amount of money, albeit in a different form, comes into the industry. And as he was saying, that sort of misses the point in a way. The question should be how much money should the government need to pay to deliver the natural capital, these ecosystem services that it wants farmers to deliver that the market won't provide. And as he was saying, there are things that you can do to prepare for this. You can start looking at things like climate change mitigation on your farm. You can look into carbon trading, offsetting, and things like, well, we've talked about them on the podcast before, things like biodiversity net gain and all of that sort of stuff. You need to really sort of get on top of your game and plan for the future rather than just sort of sit back and think, well, I'm just going to be able to recoup the amount of money I used to get from BPS through the forthcoming ELM scheme, the Environmental Land Management Scheme, because quite simply, you probably won't be able to recoup all of that money. So make sure your business is resilient and make sure you're sort of looking at diversified income streams and that kind of thing.
You've got to think out the box. It's not all going to come through ELMs. The other thing, of course, that's happened this week is yet again another government environment announcement. Boris, absolutely keen for everyone to do their thing to cut carbon. And he's talking once again about carbon taxes. They've obviously taxed airlines. They've taxed heavy industry. They're now talking about taxing agriculture, food producers and other carbon hungry industries or anything that's basically emitting carbon. He's, according to the Times this week, told all the departments to run off and start to come up with how this is going to happen, it could just be more hot air. The bottom line is he's in a bit of a corner to do it, because obviously the COP27 or whatever it is, 26, the big environmental conference that we're hosting in Glasgow in November, obviously the UK has got to be seen to be doing the right thing, but I hope it's not going to be at the detriment of our producers that we get taxed, or the products we produce get taxed at the retail end only to be undercut by imports coming in where they're not taxed at all, or certainly they're not taxed when they're producing them. So it's got to be a level playing field. But yes, is it more hot air or is it actually some policy which might actually come to some fruition?
Yeah, that Times report, Hugh, really interesting. Apparently it was based on a Whitehall memo seen by the newspaper. But the same evening, the Sun was then reporting a senior number 10 official saying that this carbon tax on meat and cheese was categorically not going to happen. They were not going to be imposing a meat tax on the Great British Banger or anything else. I don't know whether this was kite flying or whether this was somebody speaking out of turn or whether it was just a memo that was an idea that grew legs, as it were, and became a story. They're playing it down as that story came about.
Either way, more really definitive and defined policy statements from the government, which aren't based on hearsay. What a refreshing change that makes. Not.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Now, next week sees the high point of the awards calendar. It is, of course, the Farmers Weekly Awards. Everyone will have a seat at this year's awards. You'll be able to watch them online every night in a five-part show starting on Sunday, and then concluding on Thursday evening, all next week. And as well as featuring all the shortlisted farmers and the winners of the various categories, there'll also be some special guests, including Prince Charles and Defra Minister George Eustace. Presenting the whole show is Country Farm presenter and Cotswold farmer Adam Henson.
The Farmers Weekly Awards is a wonderful event that's held every year, and obviously this year it's got to be a bit different. So it's going to be done online, but we've been out into the field around the country filming so that the awards are exciting and vibrant with lots of content rather than us just stood in a boring studio presenting them for people to watch online. And so it's going to be exciting and really, I think, quite fulfilling meeting some of the candidates, although online, hearing their stories. There's me presenting. We've got Carl Schneider, who's the retiring editor for Farmers Weekly. And then guests like Minette Batters from the NFU. So should be good.
Andrew Robinson from Bedfordshire was the Farm Manager of the Year in 2019 and also took the overall Farmer of the Year award.
The process of judging, I thought, was superb. You know, it really focuses your attention. Also, should that, you know, when you become successful and win the prize, then you go on to, you know, the joy of seeing other farms and judging that. And, I, you know, it's such a strict process. I didn't quite realise quite what was involved until I went on the judging panel. And it's just so honest, so clear, so detailed. I didn't actually realise just how detailed the judges actually go into when they come and visit. However, but that only makes me make the win even more special.
New farming entrant Emma Boyle from Hampshire won the 2019 Diversification winner with her wool yarn business.
Some of our neighbours have sort of been a bit sniffy about sheep and wool and knitting and not really seen it as a proper business, which obviously it is. To sort of have that sort of validation from the farming community was absolutely fantastic. But it also gave us wider coverage, and subsequently we were on Country File and we've been on Sky News. So it's been great for our promotion of the company in the sort of wider media.
Adam Henson told us that the awards really helped to inspire and promote excellence in UK agriculture.
I think it's absolutely essential for the agricultural industry, or for any business really, to be able to celebrate success and to be able to look at those people in the industry who are really leading and taking things forward and doing them so well. Agriculture in Britain, you know, is absolutely brilliant. We're some of the best food producers in the world. And we need to celebrate that success and give those individuals who are doing so well a boost, but also to inspire those who want to do better.
Adam Henson there, of course, who will be presenting the Farmers Weekly Awards starting on Sunday night. Johan, how can I watch the Farmers Weekly Awards?
Well, Hugh, these awards are going to be spread across 5 20-minute programmes taking place over 5 consecutive nights from the 7th to the 11th of February, each starting at 6 o'clock. And you'll be able to tune in and find out who takes home the coveted yellow plaque in each night's categories, as well as hearing from special guests and, of course, a chance to hear and see the achievements of more than 40 of the best farmers in the land. You'll be able to watch this on fwi.co.uk/show. It will also be on Facebook at Farmers Weekly UK, on YouTube at Farmers Weekly Video, and on Instagram at Farmers Weekly. So there'll be entertainment, laughter, perhaps a few tears, and of course, a great night for everybody.
Great stuff. So I shall be tuning in and seeing what's going on. Sounds really good. Best of luck to all of those people who have been shortlisted to win an award. Presumably next week, Johan, we will be able to feature and talk to some of the winners.
I certainly hope so. There's going to be so much entertainment. It will be really fun. You remember we did we covered the Farmers Weekly Farm Inventions competition a few weeks ago on the podcast. So machinery fans will be able to see some of the gadgets and contraptions that have entered for that competition, and hear from the farmers who devised and built them. And then the whole event will culminate on Thursday, the 11th of February, when we'll be revealing who the judges have chosen as the overall Farmers Weekly 2020 Farmer of the Year. And yes, we hope to get at least a few of them on next week's podcast.
We do indeed. That is it for this week's podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to tune into the Farmers Weekly Awards starting on Sunday night and concluding with all the big announcements on Thursday night. Don't forget to tune into those. Until next week, though, on the Farmers Weekly podcast, have a lovely week and we shall see you then. Goodbye.
Goodbye.